My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pahl and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which is about words ending in phobia, which indicates a strong and sometimes morbid aversion. So for one mark, what would you dislike or dread or have a morbid fear of if you suffered from the following? And I'm bound to warn the team that some of these are what they call nonce words, coined for use on one particular occasion or coined at the moment. Begin with Frank Muir. Your first word is pogonophobia. P-O-G-O-N-O-P-H-O-B-I-A. Pogonophobia.
Nice to begin with a simple one. Yeah. It's the fear of being forbidden to ride your pogo stick.
Nice thought.
But that's it. Don't pause, Jack, and wait for further.
It might induce you to shave in the morning.
Shave. Come on, Gerald. Greek. Is it Greek? Pogo.
Pogo.
Pogo, no. No, pogo.
Fear of beards, obviously.
Never.
Fear of beards.
Okay.
A mark.
Who's going to fear beards?
It's a morbid.
Depends,
I said sometimes morbid.
Barbers.
Anne Scott James, yours is musophobia. M-U-S-O, and then phobia. And
it's that's afraid of being poisoned by a shellfish, obviously.
That would be musculophobia.
Well, you have a point. Well, what about one of those heavy hints, much like shaving?
Well, it's a bit rodent.
Oh, of course it is. It's when you jump on a chair and pull up your skirts above your knees and scream.
Well, you might do that for many reasons.
When a mouse emerges. Let me finish. When a mouse emerges.
That's quite right.
Fear of mice.
It's a fear of mice. Right. One more. Dennis Norton, yours is clinophobia, C-L-I-N-O, and then phobia, clinophobia.
Clinophobia gives me no help at all. It's not like being afraid of being on the side of a hill.
Yes, it's roughly there.
That's what it is.
It's indoors there.
On the side.
Wouldn't happen in a bungalow.
Well, if you swept all the dust under the carpet for long enough, you would have an indoor hill.
And do you like it or not?
No, I wouldn't like it at all. I'd be afraid to walk up it.
Fear of going upstairs.
That's right. Fear of going upstairs or going up a slope. Downstairs. That's why I say it's indoor, which is more likely to be upstairs than just up a slope, even in Dennis's house. Oh, well. Dennis Powell, your turn. Triskaidekaphobia.
Triskaidekaphobia.
Useful and everyday word.
Ah, yes.
You may take notes.
Well, I live at the house which is numbered in the street 14.
Yes, you've only just escaped Triskaidekaphobia.
And I'm not sure if the next one is called 13 or not. I think it may not be. But it's afraid of... I mean, in modern Greek, it comes dekatris. But in your classical Greek, Jack, which is so much grander than mine, it's 13. So it's fear of 13.
Fear of 13 is what makes the hotel proprietor. Yeah. Isn't it? Three bedrooms in a row. One is called 12, one is called 12A, and the next is called 14, because he's frightened about 13, or his guests, maybe.
Or a mother of 12 children who goes off her husband.
You can't have 12 and a half, at least I don't think you can. Your turn again, Frank. Gymnophobia, G-Y-M-N-O, gymnophobia.
Ooh. It's lovely like the... My constant companion says that it's fear of nakedness.
That's right. That's right.
I had that when I was a very small boy.
Not much of that about the Western cinema.
Well, I had that when I was a very, very small boy at school. And oddly enough, ironically enough, it was gym. I hated gym.
Yeah.
Because I had to sort of slip my trousers down to put my gym. And I was not worried about
it. I used to be have a morbid fear of showing my vest.
Is there a vestophobia? Singletomania.
Ascot James' turn. Allophobia. A-U-L-O. Allophobia.
Fear of everything.
Something to do with winds, I should think.
Yes. Something to do, yes, which you need a wind or a kind of wind in order to make it work.
Oh, fear of using a vacuum cleaner.
Well, take it the other way around and don't suck in, but blow out.
Blow out, yes. A fear of bursting. Blowing too hard when you talk.
Well, what are you blowing?
A wind instrument.
Yes, that's what I wanted. It's a fear of flutes or wind instruments. One more.
How can you fear a flute?
Right.
What do you suspect is going to happen to you? What's somebody going to do to you with a flute?
They play all night.
I think it makes a difference if it's well played or bad.
Yes, that makes a difference too.
You have a morbid fear of it.
Dennis Norton, yours is simpler. Parthenophobia. Parthenophobia.
It's either having a fear of having the Parthenon fall on you, or you're standing having your photograph taken.
It's mostly falling
on you. Is it like parthenogenesis?
Yes, that sort of thing. Yes. Yes, that's the right line.
What's parthenogenesis? It means fear of virgins.
Yes, that's right.
Sounds more respectable.
That's all right.
It's your trouble.
I don't know that it applies to Dennis. It's fear of young girls. One more. Back to Dennis Powell. Yours is phobophobia. P-H-O-B-O. Phobophobia.
A fear of being afraid.
That's right. Fear of fear. One more. Well, before we get on to the next round, here are the quotations for the last round for Frank and Dennis. And Frank, yours is, "We lost our little Hannah in a very painful manner." And yours, Dennis, is, "Every prospect pleases and only man is vile." Well, now we have a round of assorted emergencies of a very odd kind. Two marks. How would you, or rather should you, rise to the occasion and cope with these emergencies one after the other? Frank Muir, you're called upon to stop a dogfight between, say, a fox terrier and an Afghan hound.
Well, I suppose, as we're in the realms of literature, Bill Sykes would kick it in the ribs.
Yes.
And Elizabeth Browning would hurl a book of sonnets in Portuguese. I think that the best way of stopping this kind
you
of...
You assume, Frank, that they're already entangled.
Yeah. Whether they're entangled in an amateur sense or aggressive sense. A bucket of water is the specific remedy, yes. But one never seems to have a bucket of water. From experience, I would say that the thing to do is to rip off your coat. Yes. And put it rapidly around the animals' heads, because whereupon they were disentangled, because they don't like fighting and being in the dark.
I think that would work, and I think you could get your marks. I have a different recipe offered to me by the compiler, who says take the smaller dog, which is obviously a good deal safer, fox terrier, for instance, by the tail, and lift it clear of the ground simultaneously, shouting, "Stop, Lego," into the ear of the larger dog. And then Frank's friend, who is a helpful bystander, has got a bucket, and he assists by sprinkling water off. He hasn't got water. He has a packet of pepper in his pocket, and he sprinkles pepper over both dogs' heads.
I think we should lift the compiler by the tail.
But anyway, yours is obviously an equally effective method, and you get your two marks. And Scott James, a child in your charge has an attack of croup. That is breathlessness, noisy breathing, and a high-pitched continuous cough. What do you do?
Well, just expose it, I think, on the hip. Finish it off. Oh, I know what you do.
Yes.
You ring for the doctor.
Yes.
Just put it in its cot.
And until the doctor arrives, while it's coughing itself, like nobody's business.
Got any sort of experience of doctors?
No, I never. I just hit them, whatever it is. Most things, I don't know. That croup.
Have you got a basin of hot steaming water?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, let it sort of inhale loosely, roughly.
I think one and a half.
But I think, in fact, I would give it a teaspoonful of honey.
Yes, that'd be a very good one.
This would be quite seriously, as the successful mother of two children reared to maturity, this would probably be what would happen.
Well, don't you fly them in an open cockpit aeroplane?
Not handy, like a bucket of water. No, your first part, certainly send for the doctor at once. It's usually one
air. Let it inhale steam, you say.
That's right. You shut windows and things, and you hold the child's head over a basin of steaming hot water.
Better with a towel over it.
Yes, towel over it and mum. Otherwise, it gets rather frightened. So you both have to inhale balsam in a steaming hot water basin. This is the traditional remedy.
And Jack, if you've got two dogs with croup who are fighting, you put the towel over both of them.
You need to.
Anyway, one and a half, I think. Dennis Norton, the front of your best evening silk shirt is marred by a firmly stuck blob of chewing gum. Now, I may be a snob, but I don't know how you can conceivably get yourself into that position. But if you will imagine yourself into it, how do you get away from it?
Well, there are two other assumptions in that question. One is that I have a silk evening dress shirt, which I haven't. And the other one is I have a best evening silk shirt, which must imply I have three of them, because it would be the better one if there's only two. Now, if I could afford to have three silk evening shirts, if I had a blob of chewing gum on it, I would insert in that blob of chewing gum a small, exquisitely cut diamond. I would then get two more bits of chewing gum and put them further down. I would then have more diamonds in those. I would then have a matching set of diamond setting chewing gum. And if you've got diamonds and a silk shirt, everybody's going to say he's terribly rich and rather eccentric. But nobody cares.
This is what I've got, but I can't fault it. I'm going to give you too much straight away. But what I've got is remove the shirt and place it in the fridge, or better still, in the deep freeze. After about 30 minutes, the blob of gum will have frozen solid and can be lifted off.
Ketchup.
Yes, but it spoils the flavour.
Anyway, to get to 2 marks. Now, Dennis Powell, this is very unfortunate indeed. Your dancing partner is painfully immobilized by violent cramp down one leg. What do you do?
I leave him.
It's supposed to be a cure, not a desertion.
Well,
take his shoe off and bend his big toe back.
That's right. Absolutely right.
Really?
Yes, frankly, he's quite right.
I do it in the middle of the night.
Yes, you remove the shoe from the affected leg, you stand the sufferer on it, and you, as Frank quite rightly says, you pull the toes sharply upwards. If the toes come away in your hand, you ask whether the discotheque has a comprehensive insurance policy. Otherwise, you're on Mount Everest. So, but you get your 2 marks. Well, now, in this round, for 2 marks, what would you suppose or expect an Australian to mean by the following phrases? Frank Muir, a duck's dinner.
Charlie Drake. I presume this is one of those funnies, isn't it?
Like, I think so, yes.
Duke Humphrey, dining with Duke Humphrey.
That's right.
A duck's dinner was presumably water.
Absolutely right. A drink, drink of water and nothing to eat. 2 marks. Anne Scott. Anne Scott James. To bat the breeze. BREEZE. To bat the breeze.
The American is better. Shoot the breeze.
Yes, sir.
Means just to stop and have a chat and.
Yes?
It's sort of desultory sort of chat.
Waffle away.
That's it, waffle away. Chattering or nattering, gossiping. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, this is up to our street. To go see Mrs. Murray.
I can only assume it means something vulgar.
Yes, that's right.
Does it mean the same as to point Percy at the porcelain?
Yes. All right, we'll take that. To visit the loo or lavatory. Ellis Powell, yours is a bit different. Yours is an amen snorter.
Amen snorter?
Mm.
Oh, a rather bogus religious character.
Needn't necessarily be bogus.
A religious character without the bogus.
Snorter.
Preacher? Learned partner says preacher.
Preacher?
Yes, that'll go.
Preacher.
A clergyman, preacher, or somebody with pronounced evangelistic tendencies, 2 marks. Oh, now we come to the last round. And Frank and Dennis's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. Frank, yours was, "We lost our little Hannah in a very painful manner," which I believe is from a chap called Max Adler, an American humorist, a sort of set of cautionary tales.
I've been terribly kind to the listening hundreds in never mentioning my book. But I must tell you something about it tonight. I have to explain why one of the quotations isn't accredited sufficiently fully. You see, it's a difficult book to describe. It's a kind of retelling of social history in which quotations are inserted, rather like exotic fruit in a failed Yorkshire pudding. And all the quotations are against. And the important thing to me was to get the background of these quotations, not just the quotations. They have things like, somebody said, "Vegetarianism is harmless enough, although it is apt to fill a man with wind and self-righteousness," which is nice, but it's also nice to know that it was said by Sir William Hutchison, who was president of the Royal College of Physicians at the time. Sir Walter Scott tried his hand occasionally at sort of patriotic poetry. He was very patriotic, but he wasn't a very good patriotic poet. But after Waterloo, he wrote a very long poem about the plains of Waterloo, really to help relieve the suffering of the widow. It was very worthwhile, but it's a terrible poem. And somebody wrote about this poem, "The corpse of many a hero slain pressed Waterloo's ensanguined plain, but none by salvo or by shot fell half as flat as Walter Scott." Which is a very nice little comment. But to find out who said it, it was actually written by a chap called, he was the first Baron Erskine, and he was Lord Chancellor, and he was a self-made man, a solicitor. And at the age of 15, he'd been struck by lightning. Well, that's what I mean about these little sort of background pieces of information. It sort of explains everything, the fact that he'd been struck by lightning at the age of 15. And these bits of information, which are called Arna, you know, like Shakespeareana or whatever, are the things that I was searching for this book. And I was searching for them mostly at a place called the London Library, which is a vast building in St. James's Square, and was founded to have books open on the shelves that people who were researchers could go in and actually pull the books down. One morning, there was a lady novelist bounded round a corner and saw Lord David Cecil lying prone on the floor. And she suspected the worst, and she sprang forward, being a resourceful woman, and gave him artificial respiration. And she got the knees into the back of the lungs and pressed forward. 1, 2, 3, and back. 1, 2, 3. And after about 3 minutes, "I don't know what you're doing, madam, but I'm looking on the bottom shelf for Locke's Essay on Human Understanding." It was in these circumstances that I was searching for my Arna. I wanted some information about cottage industries, about home weaving, and I got out Silas Marner. And I was there with a helper, the vicar's wife, who held Silas Marner for me. And I also wanted, and this is the important thing, to back up a line which Dennis had given me. And it was the first quotation I had to start my book. And Dennis had given it to me from his commonplace book, and he will remember it. It's from Chekhov.
who said, "I do not understand the ballet, except that I do know that during the intervals, the dancers stink like horses." And I wanted to find out about this. So I wanted Chekhoviana. And I got an old envelope, and I was going through the books, and I found out things about Chekhov. You know, he got married to an actress, and he had a puppy called Muir. Apparently there's a firm in Moscow, a Scottish firm called Muir, and he named his puppy after it. And I wrote up Miana and shoved it in the Silas Marner. And I was lying like Lord David Cecil, really trying to find out from his letters when he actually said this. And a poet galloped past and kicked the volume of Silas Marner, and it flew out of my hands, hit the wall, and dropped down behind the rack of books. Now, I was on the top floor, and I had this hideous sight of seeing Silas Marner drop down four flights and strike a reverend gentleman who was bent over the books in the back of the neck. Now, Silas Marner is quite a small book, even though full of my bits, but it obviously was very hurtful to the reverend gentleman who swore in that sort of modified way one swears in libraries in Latin. So I had to flee the premises. So this is really to explain that when you see the book, the quotation of "I do not understand the ballet" is just got Anton Chekhov and his dates. I can't give you any of the background, the Anna information. I had it, but the vicar's wife and I, we lost our little Anna in a very painful manner.
Well, that'll keep people away from the London Library, and we go on to Dennis, and if you remember, his quotation was, "Every prospect pleases and only man is vile," which is the hymn, I think, by Bishop Reginald Heber.
Well, despite their usefulness in getting globs of chewing gum off silk dress shirts, let me tell you some of the reasons why I'm one of the few people who is still unconverted to this present craze for living out of deep freezers, what you might call the second ice age. You see, quite apart from the fact that frozen food always looks so unattractive. I mean, have you ever seen a hamburger that's been in a freezer? It takes on the appearance of an ice hockey puck. But quite apart from that, when a small freezer is as packed to capacity as ours always is, what it becomes is a downright hazard. If you open the freezer door with anything less than the most extreme caution, do you know what happens? You find yourself limping for 3 days. It kind of wallop right on your foot. Do you realize that we have become the first generation who succeeded in making it scientifically possible for a pint of chicken soup to fracture your instep? On top of that, the other great abiding snag is that when you take something out of a freezer, there is no way of recognizing what it is. Do you remember in Gone with the Wind how Scarlett O'Hara said, "As God is my witness, I'll never go hungry again"? Well, when a deep freeze arrives in a woman's kitchen, that becomes, "As God is my witness, I'll never go short of veal stock again." Within 1 week of purchase, 85% of the interior cubic footage of our machine was taken up by those rotten oblong plastic containers, every one of which was bursting its lid with that gleaming sort of beige-coloured solid substance that simple veal stock becomes when it's subjected to the freezing process. What's more, every one of these containers, which are called frost packs, every one of these frost packs was unlabeled. Now, why I stress that last word, unlabeled, is because there's only one thing that I have ever wanted to have a deep freeze for. It was to ensure that I always had at hand an adequate supply of coffee ice cream. Now, to me, and I've knocked around the world a bit, to me, there is nothing that mankind has created that matches the nobility of coffee ice cream. But when all your frost packs are unlabeled, and 85% of them are veal stock, well, can you imagine anything that can damage your taste buds more irreparably than to gear them up to expect coffee ice cream, then at the very first lick, send down wet veal. Now, I do realise that my attitude to these domestic cold comfort farms may place me in a minority, so I can only hope that I've explained why, as far as coffee ice cream is concerned anyway, I seem to be in a position where, as the old hymn has it, every frost pack freezes and only mine is veal.
Well, that was a domestic tragedy. And by your vote, nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the story. But Dennis Power and Frank Muir in the other team win the entire contest.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Schreiner.